So our guest this week is Chris Frantz, the drummer of the Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club. And thanks for coming on, Chris.
Hi, Fred. It's a great pleasure. I'm happy we're able to get together like this.
It's interesting with the coronavirus now, a worldwide epidemic. It's shifted everything for everyone on so many different levels. I mean, we watched Jimmy Fallon or whomever on late night, and they're all quarantined into whatever, you know, home they chose to broadcast from. And our podcast, Promotion Man Podcast, has been somewhat on hiatus because we hadn't have access to our studios.
Right.
Uh-huh. So we wanted to give this platform a try. And so thank you for being our first interview on it.
You know, I always like to be first.
So let me kind of go back to when I first met you and the band Talking Heads. You were signed to Sire, and they had a distribution agreement with ABC Records.
That's right.
And that was the debut album, Talking Heads 77, I think, which was in the fall of 77.
Yeah, I think though, gosh, was Talking Heads 77 distributed by ABC? I think didn't Seymour make the deal with Warner's just before our record came out?
You know what? And he may have. That's kind of why I was asking, because that was the fall of 77 and I joined Warner Brothers March of 78. So when I stepped into my job as the Detroit and the Michigan Warner Brothers representative, Psycho Killer was really doing well in the college arena. Uh-huh. And the college radio stations, which L.A. Lloyd had got his start in college, were the ones that would really start some of these records that mainstream radio would eventually embrace, but it took them a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So that was, and it was such a great song. It had such a hypnotic intro. And that was a lot of fun. And then we had the pleasure of interviewing Alice Cooper.
Yeah, that was great.
Which I remember I texted you, Chris, because he had his own point of view about the Psycho Killer, right, LA?
Oh, did he? Yeah. Well, yeah, Dead Babies. I mean, remember those songs? I got you under my wheels. You know, there's that photo of you and Alice Cooper and Talking Heads. And Bernie Taupin. That was when he made a record with Bernie Taupin writing lyrics for him.
Yeah. So you know what he told us, Chris, is that he went into a psycho ward because of alcoholism, because back then they didn't have a behavioral health or a treatment center really structured for alcoholics. And he got in there and he called Bernie and said, there are so many characters in here. I need you to help me write this album. It was called From the Inside Out.
Right.
But it was fun to have Alice on the show because he's a fellow Detroiter like I am. Uh-huh. And I happened to grow up in a neighborhood where Mitch Ryder, the lead singer of Mitch Ryder and Detroit Wheels, literally lived right behind us and a couple doors down and went to high school with my sister.
Are you friends with Johnny B?
Yes, actually.
I love Johnny B. I love Mitch Ryder too, but I've never actually met him.
Yeah, and being a drummer, I could see because Johnny's a great drummer. But when we were finishing our interview with Alice, I referenced that photo. And I said, I referenced that photo. And he goes, do you know that the Talking Heads wrote that song about Alice Cooper? And we're like, what?
That was news to me for sure.
Well, it was not David came to Tina and I with the song. He had started a song. He had the first verse and the chorus. This was at the Rhode Island School of Design before Talking Heads. Tina and I shared a painting studio. We were studying painting, but I had a band with David called the Artistics, which was mostly a cover band. We had aspirations to at least one day play original material. David came to our studio. He said, look, I've started this song. It's called Psycho Killer. And I said, oh, wow. He said, I need somebody to write. I would like to ask Tina to write the bridge of the song, the middle part of the song, in a foreign language, in French, because he knew that Tina spoke French. Her mother is from France. And so Tina agreed to do it. But what he told us at that time was it was in the spirit of an Alice Cooper song.
Right.
Not actually about Alice Cooper, but like in that spirit where you're kind of tongue in cheek and kind of horrifying at the same time.
You know? Yeah.
And that's how we could all relate to it. But it, in fact, it sounds more to me like a Velvet Underground meets Otis Redding or something like
yeah,
that.
Right? Yeah, I could see that. So do you remember the first time that Ken Kushnick came into your dressing room and you met him?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the first time I remember it was at the Rathskeller in Boston.
Wow.
On Kenmare Square, I think it's called. And that was kind of like the CBGB of Boston, actually very much like the CBGB of Boston. And Ken got hired by Seymour to kind of run the show, really, at Sire Records, the same day that we signed an agreement to a recording contract with Seymour. It was November 1st, 1976.
Wow.
And that's the day Seymour also hired Ken, which I think is maybe not a coincidence. but anyway, because we had no management, you know, we were self-managed. And I was already keenly aware that self-managing is not a good idea, that really the guys at the record company don't want to give the artist any bad news or get tough with them.
Right.
You got to have a buffer.
Yeah, it's someone in the middle, take the heat.
Yeah, and Ken kind of, besides everything else he did at Sire, which was considerable, he also kind of, I wouldn't really say he managed us, but he gave us a lot of managerial advice.
Right. Well, I got a little piece of audio here I want you to play. We had Kenny on the show a few months ago, and this is kind of his first feelings about Talking Heads. Check this out.
You know, the next thing I know, a band starts playing, and it's clearly not the Ramones. I don't know who it is. I have a combination of the John Landau, I have seen the future of rock and roll moment, crossed with the John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever, I'm falling in love with the girl and everything's in slow motion moment.
Wow.
That band turned out to be Talking Heads.
So that's pretty cool right there when he said that. I'm really glad to be able to play that for you.
It's very nice of Ken to speak so highly of us.
He definitely did. So the record that I had complete involvement with, because I got on the tail end of Psycho Killer, was more songs about buildings and food, which had Take Me to the River.
Yeah.
And that just absolutely exploded for us at Warner Brothers at the same time that we've got Prince and Van Halen and Fleetwood Mac and the Doobie Brothers, which were, you know, so a lot of different genres of music. And my question to you is who decided to cover that specific song?
Well, we loved Al Green. Like Tina and I especially loved Al Green, but so did David. And I had a number of Al Green records and, you know, LPs in my collection, and I played them all the time because Al Green, to me, his records were good if you were happy. They were good if you were sad. They were good if you wanted to, like, get sexy. They were good if you if you wanted to just chill out. They were really sort of all around great records to me. And with our band that we had at the Rhode Island School of Design, which was called the Artistics, with the Artistics, we had covered Love and Happiness, that Al Green song. When we started playing at CBGB's, we didn't play Love and Happiness, even though we could have. We chose to play Take Me to the River instead. I remember David saying that he particularly liked the lyrics because it was getting Jesus and sex and, you know, cigarettes and everything all mixed up.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So we started playing Take Me to the River down at CBGB's, and we played it much more up-tempo than the eventual recording was. Like when we went into the studio with Eno to record the song, we had been playing it live for years already, but like Al Green did it, it was kind of an up-tempo version. Eno said to us, you know what? You should slow this down and play it as slow as you possibly can without fucking up. And this was down at Compass Point in the Bahamas. We were having a ball, and I think maybe Take Me to the River was the last song we recorded. We followed Eno's advice, and we listened to the playback. You know, it wasn't easy, like, slowing it down that much. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's much harder to play a slow song really well than it is to play a fast song.
Right.
But we tried it, and then we listened to the playback, and we were like, oh yeah, this is
right?
So much more sexy. And there's all this space in the song now that allowed for Eno to use his like drum treatments. And I think he probably treated the bass and the keyboards as well with this little pocket synthesizer. Not pocket, excuse me, briefcase size synthesizer that he had, you know, parked on the console of the recording studio. And he would just run, say, a snare drum through this little synthesizer. And it was not a synthesizer with a keyboard like we know now. It's one with little pegs that you pull in and out. Oh. And you know, you pull out two pegs and you get a sound that goes boom, and you pull out three pegs and you get a sound that goes bam. so he treated the drums, and it really sounds cool.
And it's super cool. And then in 1979, Fear of Music came out, and that's when Once in a Lifetime, I think, established the Talking Heads as a band that definitely had their own original, not only sound, but music, because Psycho Killer didn't hit the masses the way Taking Me to the River did. And Taking Me to the River was a cover. So yeah. Once in a Lifetime, really, I think, is when people...
Well, I think, let me just jump in. I think you might be thinking of Life During Wartime. Once in a Lifetime was on the fourth record, Remain in Light.
Oh, you know what? You're right. Yeah, you're absolutely. Thank you for correcting me.
I don't mean to sound
pedantic. Who would know better than you?
That's what you're here for today, to make it right.
But you thought Once in a Lifetime, or that's the song you're thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a hell of a song.
Well, I mean, Life During Wartime, I mean, if that song came out as a current today with protest and pandemic, how do you think people would react to this song in 2020, Chris?
I think people would dig it.
Yeah, I do too.
Someone should do a remix.
Right.
Why didn't I think of that?
Who wrote the lyrics for that? I mean, you know, this ain't no party. This ain't no disco. This ain't no fooling around. I mean, those are the most iconic, you know, lyrics for a song that's so easily to grab onto.
Very striking lyrics, very commanding lyrics. David wrote those.
Yeah.
And they are brilliant.
They are. And then, of course, people love to hear their city. And I grew up in Detroit. And so, as you know, heard about Houston, heard about Detroit, heard about Pittsburgh, PA.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and so and all those fans are like, yeah.
It's nice how he says Detroit instead of Detroit. Yeah. We recorded that album and that song, Life During Wartime, the Fear of Music album, in our loft in Long Island City, which was kind of a daring move at the time. You know, now everybody has home recording equipment and stuff, but back then we that didn't really exist. And what we had to do was have the record plant mobile truck, like a recording studio built into a truck. And they pulled up outside the building where Tina and I lived, where the band rehearsed, where we wrote most of the songs for that album. Anyway, Eno thought it was a good idea. The band thought it was a good idea. Instead of going into a studio, we just record the songs where we actually made them, you know, where they originally were written. And Life During Wartime was one of a number of songs on that record that really sound hip and modern and still contemporary. I mean, think of the song called Air, which is on that album, which is about the environment and, you know, and about that. But anyway, those are very interesting recordings.
So, Chris, when MTV came along, I mean, obviously it made careers, but then you had to start thinking about the video element instead of just the music. So just kind of curious, I mean, because obviously you got a lot of airplay on MTV and you had some great videos. When did you start thinking about how you needed to make them both work hand in hand so it would be a success for you as well in MTV? Because it was so huge when it really took off.
Yeah. Well, you know, I our manager, Gary Kerfurst, did you guys know Gary?
Yeah, I did. I liked him a lot. He was really a good guy.
Ken Kushnick introduced us to Gary Kerfurst, and we were looking for a manager, you know, and Ken said, "Well, I know this guy, Gary Kerfurst." We wanted Ken to be our manager, but he said, "If I'm your manager, then there's nobody left in your corner at Sire." So I said, "Oh, yeah." And he introduced us to Gary, and Gary said about MTV, Gary had a lot of experience in the music business. And he said about MTV, "Oh, man, it's going to be all about makeup and pretty girls and pretty boys, and it's going to ruin the music business." Because, you know, he was a former manager of people like Leslie West.
Oh, wow.
Mountain.
Yeah. And
little turn to go with the Talking Heads.
Yeah. But anyway, we didn't really think about video that much, or at least I didn't. We thought of it as something that was used in art galleries.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
To create conceptual art. But while we were taking a break from Talking Heads, a vacation, I know Tina and I were down in the Bahamas with, we had just had our first child, our first son down there. And we had just finished recording the album that became Speaking in Tongues. But David had a girlfriend at the time named Tony Basil. Remember that song, Mickey?
Mickey.
And she's been around a long time, and she has done a lot of great stuff in her lifetime. But she was kind of romantically linked with David at the time. And David went out to L.A. to visit her. And I think what kind of happened was that Tony said, "There's going to be this new thing called MTV. You should make a video." And so she kind of directed that once in a lifetime video for David, helped him put it all together.
Nice.
And he did it like as he would have liked to do many things without the rest of us, sort of like, he didn't ask us, "Hey, is it okay with you if I make a video?" No, he didn't say that. But when we got back from the Bahamas, and our album Remain in Light had already been out for quite a while already when MTV debuted. He used that song, Once in a Lifetime, and when we saw the video, we just said, "Oh, well, there's no denying that this is a good video." Mm-hmm. And so we were happy to use it during the advent of MTV because it was cool, you know, and it wasn't it wasn't about pretty boys and makeup and stuff like that. It was about it was sort of multicultural, and it was trippy without being like cliched psychedelic trippy. Right. It was a new kind of trip.
Yeah. And then right at that time, you guys started bringing in some interesting characters, Bernie Worrell from the Funkadelics. yep. Noah Hendrix, and they alone started to add these layers of your sound, which was really pretty awesome. Because, you know, you now take the sound that you guys have created and add these interesting, flavorful characters.
Yeah.
There's a more of a depth now, especially on the percussion side, but certainly, you know, having Adrian Ballou on guitar, and it was very interesting process. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, we had made this record Remain in Light, which was kind of, let's just say it was very unexpected and sort of on the verge of being avant-garde.
Zimbra.
Yeah, but it was also inspired by African high life rhythms and things we listened to at home, Manu Dibango, Soul Makossa, wow. Stuff like that. And so that was the kind of stuff that we loved to listen to when we were having a party or something. And with Remain in Light, none of the songs had been written in advance because we'd just been touring. And we went into the studio with Brian Eno, and we just started writing songs in the studio, one instrument at a time.
Wow.
So they all began with recording drums, and I had to play, like, I didn't know where the verses and choruses were going to be, or I had to just imagine. And so I ended up playing everything kind of like a human loop. We wow. didn't have sampling technology yet. So I had to actually play it. I couldn't just create a little loop on it. No, I had to play it for like 8 minutes or something. And then sometimes Tina would play along with me. Other times she would add her part next. And then David and Jerry would add their parts after that. And it was really a great process. Where was I going with this?
Oh, well, we were just talking about how you were bringing in Bernie Worrell and.
Oh, yes. Mona. Yes. So we had a lot of parts going on, and it was very intense kind of music a lot of times. And so when it came time to do a tour, to organize a tour, David said, oh, we can't possibly play this album with only four people, so there won't be any tour.
Oh.
And you guys were so good live.
I know. The rest of us were kind of like, hold on. We can get this together. I think Jerry spoke to Nona, and Nona put in touch with Bernie. Oh, no. I'm wrong. It was Busta Cherry Jones. Busta Cherry Jones, the bass player, who had played with Eno and who had worked with Chris Spedding and played on a lot of disco records. Busta introduced us to Bernie Worrell, and he found us Steve Scales, and he also found us Dolette McDonald, who was the touring. Eventually, she sang with us also on records, but she was very young. I mean, we all were.
Yeah, right.
But Bernie was fantastic. Bernie, of course, came from Parliament Funkadelic.
Right. And here's the thing. I grew up in Detroit. So Don was from Detroit, and Bernie. And so we had the Funkadelic signed to Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Talk about a wild deal. So Casablanca has Parliament. Warner Brothers has Funkadelic. They're the same band, basically. What a genius way to get double paid.
Right.
Yeah. George Clinton is a very savvy cat.
That he is.
Bernie was going through a bad patch with George at that time due to business matters. And so he wasn't working with P-Funk at the time. He was like estranged.
Agent.
Yeah. And that's how we got him to work with us. And he'd never heard of us. Steve Scales had never heard of us. Dolette had never heard of us. They were from a different world, you know? But when those two worlds came together, you know, it was really quite something.
Well, you know, what's interesting is I was so blessed to be at Warner Brothers at that era because there were so many amazing bands.
Yeah.
But the one thing that we had spoke about when we did a Talking Heads episode in our first few episodes of Promotion Man, was my description of you guys was basically exciting. You guys are just very exciting. It was an exciting band to watch. It was a very different type of palette of music that was easily digestible. And it was fun. And you'd want to dance and you want to move around. And it was just very, very exciting. It was you've given us all a lot of gifts.
Thank you very much. Did you see us, Fred? Did you see us in Detroit at the Punch and Judy Theater?
Yes, they sure
Oh,
did.
Man. Wow. I love those shows. We played there a couple times. We played there once, and then I think we came back again to play it on the same tour.
Well, you guys were such a mild-mannered band. We were together in Lansing, Michigan, Ann Arbor, Detroit. And you guys were just so easy to like and so easy to hang with. And then I would have Van Halen that would destroy rooms. I have Black Sabbath where Ozzy would get lost. You know, we had Funkadelics. I mean, we had Prince who would do some very bizarre things on stage. And you'd be like, what? You know? So you guys were always mild-mannered, fun band. So when I read your book, I had no idea that you actually toured. I knew you toured with the Ramones right away, right out of the gate.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that? But then I want to lead into Dire Straits, because I had no idea you toured with Dire Straits and how close you got to the B-52s, which is another Warner Brother band. Yeah. So let's start with touring with the Ramones. What was that like?
Well, it was amazing. That particular tour was in the spring of 1977. We flew over to Zurich, Switzerland is where it began. And we flew over there in April late April of 77. We were the Ramones and Talking Heads were both on Sire, of course. And the Ramones were about to release their second album, Leave Home. Mm-hmm. And we had not even finished our first album yet. We were touring on the strength of one single we made called Love Goes to Building on Fire. And it actually got some airplay in parts of Europe, you know, like Amsterdam and Brussels and London and Paris. And so these were all places we went on that tour. And it was, as I say, it was spring of 77, and we wound up at the Roundhouse in London on the Queen's Jubilee weekend, which is it was a big event. You know, people came in to party from all over the country, and a lot of people from out of town to see the splendor of the Queen riding in her gold carriage through the streets of London. But what was going on in our world was the Sex Pistols had just released their record. The Clash had just released their record. And the Slits and the Damned and this whole like phenomenon.
Dead Boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. This whole phenomenon was going on. No, the Dead Boys, they didn't have a record out yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. And so it was this punk explosion, you know, revolution, whatever you want to call it. And we were right in the thick of it. Like when we played the Roundhouse, we opened for the Ramones. There was also a band called the Saints from Australia that were signed to Sire.
Yeah, they were one of ours.
They went on before us. Then we played, and then the Ramones played. And it was intense because... And we went over very well, and it was sold out for two nights. You know, that was just a great tour. I would say for my money, it was one of the great tours of all time. Great rock and roll tours.
Nice.
The Ramones with Talking Heads in support. I mean, how can you beat that?
Right.
It doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah. So we're going to get to your book in a minute. There's a couple more questions I want to ask, and then I want to slide into the new book that you've written. But you had graciously given me an advance on it. And that's where I learned so many things about you. But I had no idea that you toured with Dire Straits, because we at Warner Brothers had Dire Straits too. And their big single was Sultan's a Swing. And we had a platinum record right out of the get-go with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's an interesting pairing, Talking Heads and Dire Straits.
Yeah. How it happened was our agent in UK and Europe was a guy named Ed Bicknell. And Ed Bicknell, we liked Ed. He worked for NEMS, which was, you know, Brian Epstein's agency that he created to handle the Beatles. And so when we heard that Seymour had somehow hooked us up with NEMS, we thought, oh, the Beatles agency? Okay, that'll do.
Yeah, right.
and Ed Bicknell was our man there. And when we were about to do our second tour of Europe, which we were headlining, he said, there's this band, I want to send you a tape of this band I'm thinking about managing. They're called Dire Straits, and I want to get your opinion if you think they're going to go anywhere.
Wow.
So he sent me the tape, and I listened to it, and I said, damn. You know, it sounds kind of like J.J. Cale and kind of like a little bit of Bob Dylan, and it's kind of like...
Very smooth.
Yeah, it's going to be really huge and mainstream, you know, album-oriented rock radio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know about England, but in America, I think they could be huge. Yeah. And Ed said, okay, how do you feel about them opening for you on this tour you're about to do? And so I played the tape for David and Jerry and Tina, and they all said, oh, that sounds nice. Okay, that's cool. Ed likes them. Okay, so that's how that happened. And we toured Europe. We toured with XTC, who were fantastic.
Yeah, great band.
Then when we came to the UK, we toured with Dire Straits as our support. And it was an extensive tour. I mean, there's a lot of colleges and universities in England, and we played them all, I think.
That's great.
Should get a degree from each one.
Yeah.
So then all of a sudden, David decides to do a solo record, and you and Tina create this concept of Tom Tom Club.
Yeah. Our hand was forced, you know, because after we did the big tour of Remain in Light with the expanded lineup and, you know, a big band, nine people on stage and a crew to match, you know, airplane tickets, hotel rooms, buses, all that adds up. And at the end of the tour, there was no money left. You know, like it broke even, I think. I think our accountant told Tina and I we each had $1,000.
Oh, wow.
after 9 months. But it was a hell of a tour. It was worth it.
Nice party.
Yeah. But anyway, David announced after that, David announced that he was going to do a solo album, not to us, but to the world. I think the world found out before we did. Then Jerry said, well, if David's doing a solo album, I'm going to do a solo album. So Tina and I looked at each other like, I guess we better do something. And we always thought of Talking Heads as the mothership. We never had any intention of, you know, like doing some side project that we would neglect Talking Heads for, you know. To us, Talking Heads was like the first child, you know. So anyway, Seymour made an agreement with David. He also made an agreement with Jerry. But when Gary Kerfers went to him and said, now Chris and Tina are going to need to do a record too, because, you know, who knows how long David and Jerry are going to take? Seymour said, I can't do three Talking Heads solo albums. So we thought, what are we going to do? And Gary Kerfers had a lot of experience working with Chris Blackwell. Gary had been involved in tours for Bob Marley in the United States, and he had managed Peter Tosh, and he had managed Toots and the Maytals, and he'd done a lot of work. In fact, when we first met Gary, his office was in the Island Records offices in New York, and his secretary was May Pang. It was so great.
Wow. You know,
we came in and I said, "Is that May Pang?" He said, "Yep, that's May Pang." but anyway, Gary said to Chris Blackwell, Chris and Tina would like to do a record. What do you think? And he said, "Well, I can appreciate the value of a good rhythm section. What do you say they come down to Compass Point and make a single? And if the single does well, then we'll do a whole album." So Gary came back to us with that. We said, "Great, that sounds great." And so we were signed to Island for Europe, the UK, and Latin America. And we didn't even have a name for the band yet. But we made the first, we had to do a single. So, well, we thought we would have to have a producer. And we thought, who should produce it? And then we thought, Lee Scratch Perry. We love him. We'll get Lee Perry to produce us. So Chris Blackwell arranged a meeting between us and Lee Perry in New York at the Howard Johnson's on 8th Avenue, which is where the Rastas like to stay. I don't know why, but they like
let them smoke pot.
Yeah, I guess so. And so we had a midnight rendezvous with Lee Perry, and we told him our idea, and he said, "Oh yeah, man, great, me can do it." So it was all set. Come on. Yeah, man, me can do it. And it was all set, and we booked the studio. We flew our gear down to the Bahamas. In those days, you could do that, you know. Not anymore, but we flew our gear down there, and we were waiting for Scratch to show up, and waiting. We ended up waiting for 2 weeks. And then finally, Gary got him on the phone, and he said, "Scratch, you know, Chris and Tina have been waiting for you. What's going on?" And Scratch said, "Well, it's about the money." And Gary said, "Okay, Scratch, what do you want?" And he said, "Oh, it's not a lot. I just want I would like $1,000 per hour."
Oh, wow.
And, yeah. And Gary said, "Well, Scratch, it sounds like you're trying to price yourself out of a gig." And Scratch said, "Oh, no, no. We'll make the album in 6 hours." So, We knew then that maybe this wasn't such a good idea after all. And Tina said, there was a young engineer at Compass Point named Stephen Stanley, who was from Jamaica. He was very young. He was like in his early 20s at this time. And he had actually recorded the basic tracks for Once in a Lifetime, because our engineer quit. While just before we recorded Once in a Lifetime, the engineer we were working with quit because he had a disagreement with Brian Eno.
hey, Chris, let me interrupt real quick, because yeah. Compass, wasn't Robert Palmer recording down there, and AC/DC, yeah. And some really big bands were.
AC/DC did Back in Black and For Those About to Rock.
Wow.
We Salute You. And Robert Palmer lived across the street from the studio.
I loved him. I loved working with him.
Yeah, he was
just a good guy.
A great guy and really knowledgeable about music.
So I wanted the listeners to realize that Compass Studios really was a place where some incredible, music was recorded.
Oh, yeah. While we were doing Tom Tom Club and the other, there were two rooms by then, two recording studios in the same building. And in the other one was Grace Jones doing
Warm Leatherette.
Yeah. Night
Pull Up to the Bumper.
Yeah. And amazing. I remember the night when they record, they set up the mics outside and recorded a Volkswagen beep, 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 beep.
Oh yeah.
But anyway,
that's like you guys using the typewriter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, so we did this. Blackwell said, record a single. So we recorded this song with this young Jamaican engineer called Wordy Rapping Hood. And Tina's two sisters sang with her on it. And Tina and I played the rest of the instruments except for a rhythm guitar. A Bahamian guy named Monty Brown played the choppy rhythm guitar. And it went top 10 in 7 countries in Europe. And it was number 1 in several countries in Latin America, including Argentina and Mexico. Mm. So it was like so exciting for us, you know, very exciting. And Chris Blackwell said, okay, now I want you to make a whole record. And so we did. And we flew Adrian Belew. Well, Tina and I recorded like the drums and bass and some keyboard parts and like, you know, the rhythm bed of the song. And then we in various songs, and then we invited Adrian down with his wife and his 2 children. And we had a wonderful time, and Adrian overdubbed guitar on all the other songs except for Wordy Rapping Hood. One of those songs, the next sort of single that we concentrated on from that album, was called Genius of Love. Chris Blackwell, Genius of Love caught on with DJs in New York City.
Everywhere, yeah.
And Chris Blackwell imported, I know it was in the hundreds of thousands. It might have been 100,000. It might have been 150,000. But anyway, it was many thousands of 12-inch singles into the United States from England. And then
this girl named Mariah Carey decides to sample it.
Yeah, that's like hitting the lottery right there.
How did that change your life?
Yeah. Well, that was a good day when we got that.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
I think she sold like 7 or 8 million records in America.
That record was at the top of the charts for many something amazing.
Yeah.
And that
was a good one.
Yeah. and it's still, Genius of Love is still sampled by primarily, you know, R&B artists, but sometimes people who are a little bit weird too like it. And so after Blackwell sold all those 12-inch singles, flooded all the DJ stores, Seymour woke up.
I bet he did.
Called up Gary and said, okay, Gary, how much do they want?
A lot.
And Gary said, yeah, after he'd passed on us and we'd had, Gary said, you know, Chris and Tina like to go boating. I think they'd like enough to buy a yacht.
Beautiful.
And, so it was a really fun time. We really enjoyed that. And the success of Tom Tom Club, I think, brought sort of a new energy to Talking Heads too, because it seemed like everybody got a recharge from that.
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and then you wrote a book, and it's called Remain in Love, off of the title Remain in Light.
Yes.
And it comes out when?
Right here. It comes out on the 21st.
Of July.
Of July, this coming Tuesday.
Oh, nice.
for those of you keeping score, we're sending some books to you.
Yes. So, Lloyd, do we have like a winner phrase or something to give these books away?
I just think they can email you and mention Genius of Love, and as long as they got those little code words in there, we'll put all the right ones in a random drawing and pull out as many as we have books for.
Beautiful. Well, thank you. And thank you for taking the time to be with us. This has been a wonderful interview. And for those of you that are interested, it's a wonderful book. I've had a wonderful time reading it. And I'm so excited to have this opportunity for you to share that with our audience. So thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much, Fred. It was a great pleasure. And it's good to see you again.
Yeah, it's great to see you as well. Our hair's a little different color.
Pardon me?
Our hair's a little different color than the last time.
Yeah, yours is a little shorter, too.
Yes, shorter and grayer.
And no porno mustache.
Yeah, oh my goodness.
How long has it actually been since you guys have seen each other?
I left Warner Brothers in 83.
Wow.
So it would have been somewhere around then.
Yeah, it's been... been a very long time, but it seems like yesterday, Fred.
The fun thing about this is that's the beauty of it. When we got like Ken Kushnick on, or Ted Cohen, or Stu Cohen, or all the, you know, we just had so much fun with these interviews because you don't really miss any time. You just keep on going. So thank you again. This has been.
How is Ted doing? Is he doing all right?
Yeah, Ted's doing well. Stu Cohen had got cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I think he's doing well. I think he's been rolling out of it. But Ted's doing well. He's in Los Angeles still and always involved in something, you know, cutting edge, whatever.
Before this COVID thing, I would see him in New York from time to time at like real serious, like downtown rock and roll bars.
Wow.
He'd come up and take my set. Chris, you remember me? And I'm say, of course, Ted. I remember you. Yeah.
You know, at South by Southwest, the real hangout for the longest time was in Austin was the Four Seasons. And Jerry Harrison walks up to me one day and he goes, you look so familiar. And I go, well, let me tell you why.
Yeah.
So we had a wonderful time. We caught up. He's a great guy.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for the interview. The book is called Remain in Love. It's out Tuesday, July 21st, 2020. Yep. And we've got some copies that we'll be giving away for some winners that say Genius of Love.
Yeah. Nice.
Very nice.
Okay. We sign off.
Thank you so much. That was a great interview. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, guys. And keep up the good work. I look forward to it. I look forward to seeing this.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, I actually met you when we launched a radio station back in the 90s when you guys were doing the heads at 101X, and we were playing your song at the time. So that was the first time I'd ever interviewed you. So, again, that was almost 25 years ago.
Yeah, that was 96.
Yeah, yes, that's exactly right. So good seeing you again. It's been a while.
Good to see you, man.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.